It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're 10 days into Movember. We'll talk to a guest who's part of Movember Milwaukee about how growing a mustache in November can help fund men's health issues.
First, hacking and cybersecurity are a huge part of the national news these days, as we talk about hacking as a privacy issue and even a national security threat. But 30 years ago, when the public was just beginning to get access to personal computers, the risks weren't that well known and hacking was a lot easier.
That all changed in 1983 when a group of Milwaukee teenagers and young men hacked the Los Alamos nuclear facility in their spare time. They sparked a media frenzy, a federal investigation, and ultimately new laws surrounding hacking.
That group is the subject of the documentary called The 414s, The Original Teenage Hackers. It's a selection at this year's Central Wisconsin Film Festival. Festival runs from November 5th to the 13th. Michael Volman is here with us now. He's the director of the documentary. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off by talking about the 414s. Who were they?
Well, the 414s was one of the first, I guess, publicized cases of computer hacking. They were a group of teenagers from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And they, you know, kind of were, you know, just getting into computers, learning more about them. They built modems. They started getting online. And from there, they kind of maybe bit off a little bit more than they could chew by hacking into the Los Alamos National Laboratory, which was a classified nuclear facility, as well as the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York.
In the 80s, if you think 80s and hacking, you've got to think of the movie War Games with Matthew Broderick. And this is a case where life imitated art a little bit. Can you talk about how War Games may have inspired these 414s?
Yeah, absolutely. In the summer of 1983, that was when the 414s really started kind of really getting online and started exploring computers other than their own, getting on, you know, networks and stuff like that. And that same summer was the year that War Games came out, which was about the same topic, a young teenager who was played by Matthew Broderick, and he managed to get online and access, I think it was the facility of NORAD, mm-hmm. You know, in the height of the Cold War. And these 414s had actually gone to the movie of War Games and were simultaneously sort of exploring computers, and they kind of had an idea to maybe explore other computers than just the local area. I think it maybe in some ways inspired them to pursue, it was sort of an accident, but at the same time, maybe more than an accident, they got a little national laboratory.
And these three guys that did this, you talk to them, you ask them, how did you do this? And they all say, oh, it was really easy. And they explain it sounds sort of easy, but was it really easy?
At the time, computers, I mean, when we think about hacking nowadays, the technology is so powerful and it's just so much more advanced than it was in the 80s. And in the 80s, you have to think, personally, I didn't even get onto the World Wide Web until, I don't know, 1996, 97, something like that. And at that point, it was still very simple. If, you know, you'd log on to a phone line and it would make these noises of the modem and things like that. Well, in the 80s, it literally was having a computer that would have a coupler attached, and you would take the phone headset, put onto couplers so that the computer could make sounds, digital noises, that would then be transferred to this modem and then, you know, use phone lines. And at the time when a lot of these big computers were set up in corporations and government facilities, maybe the person who operated the computer maybe didn't know as much as they could about them and times them with passwords or very simple file structures that allowed the quote-unquote hackers to, you know, see the file structure, figure out the way that they could get into a backdoor. A lot of it was just simply knowing the particular computers. I think it was a VAX computer at the time, and knowing that particular computer and being able to kind of read manuals, go onto message boards, and figure out pretty simple ways to get access to the computers.
We're talking to Michael Volman. Hearing some of those digital phone noises now, we're going to reconnect, hopefully on another line. I don't know if he's being hacked right now as we speak. We're talking about his new documentary. It's called The 414s, The Original Teenage Hackers. He's taking us back to 1983, a group of Milwaukee-based youth used their computer skills at the time to hack into things like Los Alamos National Laboratory, Sloan Kettering Cancer Research Center, and more. His film is airing at the Central Wisconsin Film Festival. Michael, you talked to these guys at the time. Do they have a sense like, oh, we're doing something really bad, or this is just, hey, this is a wacky thing that we teenage guys are figuring out?
I think they knew they were doing something wrong. I don't think they understood the extent of how bad, you know, what they were doing. You know, a few guys in the film kind of say, you know, we didn't really realize the full effect of our actions until the FBI came knocking on their door. And then, you know, it resulted in their mom crying and their dad, you know, worried that they weren't going to be able to go to college because they would have some kind of record. So I think it was just kids being mischievous, maybe knowing a little too much and, you know, just getting in trouble.
It is kind of interesting how it played out from there, because you had one guy, one of the three, was under the legal age. And so he was doing the talk show circuits. He was kind of having fun. He testified before Congress. He was a bit, it looked like, of a media darling. And then the other two were getting criminal charges enacted against them. How did that work out?
Yeah, that's true. I should say that although the film does have three members of the 414s, there are rumors that the group extends beyond that, and maybe I actually know it extends beyond that, but even beyond maybe four or five people, I've heard rumors that there was maybe 10, and there was maybe even females involved. But of course, you know, it's pretty hard to crack hackers and get them to all speak. So, the one of the people who is in the film, Neil Patrick, he was 17 at the time. He was underage at the time of when they got caught by the FBI, and the other individuals were 18 or older. I think one was 20, and the older adults were worried that they would be prosecuted federally. Whereas the younger Neil knew that he most likely was not going to be charged as a minor. I guess it was just at that time it was pretty difficult to charge a minor federally. And so Neil Patrick also sort of got leniency and by agreeing to sort of got a plea deal. He maybe, you know, was able to talk more publicly, maybe gave the FBI a little bit of information about the group. And so that kind of caused conflict between a few of the members. You know, some of the older guys worried that wishing they could maybe even get some of that public adoration. Because at the time, you know, this one person got famous in a way, and the other guys didn't. And they kind of had to wait to find out how they were going to be punished.
And Michael, those charges you mentioned, there wasn't such a thing as cyber crime legislation before this. They were charged ultimately, I guess, with phone harassment. But that changed soon after. These Milwaukee kids inspired a lot of today's cyber crime legislation.
That's true. I think this case, a little bit along with the movie War Games, brought this to the public so dramatically. And, you know, this was a very popular news story for the entire summer of 1983, and then also kind of got congressmen interested in this. And I think it was a part of a House Appropriations bill in 1984 that brought in six laws that pertained particularly to computer laws. And from there, those laws got kind of rolled into the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in 1986, which is still being used today to prosecute computer crimes and computer hackers.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Michael Vollman, director of The 414, is the original Teenage Hackers, about a group of young hackers in Milwaukee in the 1980s. It's a selection of the Central Wisconsin Film Festival running from November 5th through 13th. If you've noticed more mustaches lately, it's not just you. We're in the midst of Movember.
Movember is a global movement during the month of November when men start the month clean shaven and spend the next 30 days or so growing a mustache. But Movember isn't just about facial hair. It's meant to support medical research for health issues affecting men.
Dave Thorpe is with us now to talk about Movember in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you too. Do you participate in Movember? Are you growing some facial hair in honor of the event? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post maybe a picture on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dave Thorpe is the network administrator for Movember Milwaukee, and he joins us from our studios in that city. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Thanks, Rob. I appreciate being here.
So we just gave you a basic definition there of Movember, but we got to get this out of the way. How is it different from No Shave November?
Oh, my favorite question of the day. I got a lot of love for No Shave November. They're specifically more generally with the American Cancer Society. So they do great work. It's more of a catch-all for all kinds of cancers, whereas Movember is specifically focused on, in the cancer realm, prostate and testicular.
And why mustaches in particular?
Sure. Well, the mustache basically is our walking billboard. It would be our pink ribbon, if you will. October obviously being Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And, you know, Movember for a lot of men is just, it's kind of a wake-up call. And it's a realization we need to take a little more stock in our own men's health, take a little bit better care of ourselves. And a lot of the ways to do that is to start a conversation. Well, what better icebreaker, especially if people are not used to seeing you with a mustache or maybe with a full beard and mustache, shaving that down or starting fresh, like you mentioned, Veronica, on the first day of Movember, and walking around with that piece of luxury over your lip.
Well, how did Movember start?
Sure. It started 13 years ago, actually. It's a global foundation. It's an organization that started in Australia. It was just a couple of mates in a pub, as a matter of fact. And, you know, they thought, boy, really kind of fun to bring the Tom Selleck back, and whatever happened to that look. So when it first started, actually, it wasn't even about men's health awareness or any kind of a charitable movement at all. It was just some guys having a good time. And all these years later, though, it still is a good time. I mean, they do a lot of fun activities, and we have a lot of things that we do in Milwaukee all month long with our campaign. But here we are, you know, 2015 in our 13th year of Movember, and we've raised over $650 million because they said, you know, it's really about the guys and we should put something towards it. So prostate, testicular cancers, the two most common that will affect only men, obviously. The other issues that we focus on very heavily are physical inactivity, being that, you know, federal guidelines in the states, only about 50% of men are as active as they need to be. And I think those federal guidelines are probably pretty generous, pretty lenient. And men's mental health awareness, you know, the stigmas around talking about your problems, you know, being okay with, hey, I'm not just going to rub dirt on it or just bury it or drink it or eat it or smoke it. You know, with your problems, you want to be able to have those conversations. So all things stemming from the mustache, you know, it's really about awareness and guys getting in to see their doctor and kind of erasing some of those stigmas and being okay with talking about their own men's health and then doing something about it.
Talking to Dave Thorpe from Movember, Milwaukee, using mustaches as a way to raise awareness of men's health issues and raise funds to treat some of those and to fund research. You can join in. Have you participated in this? Are you doing it right now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Clarence on the line in Watertown. Clarence, hi.
Good afternoon, sir. Good afternoon. Yes, I got out of the military in 1971 and got married in 1973. Well, when I got married, I quit shaving. My wife said, you know, better to shave not at all than only shave once a week. Because in the military, sometimes I had to shave twice a day. And that was really kind of a drag. And 2 years ago, my daughter-in-law persuaded her husband, who is my son, and myself to totally shave our beards, mustaches. And I am prematurely bald, so my son shaved his head completely.
Wow.
And the Movember movement. And listening to your guest, he is spot on. Men do not like to talk about their health problems, whereas women, you know, will discuss their female cycles and everything like that. Men, you don't talk about that.
Clarence, did this get you and your friends talking about men's health issues, seeing you, this guy who hadn't shaved in, 39 years, all of a sudden, it's gone?
A number of guys, you know, at the implement dealer and at the parts store and at the fleet store, they knew about it. They knew about it. I don't know if it helped any funds be raised, but, yeah, it was definitely an interesting experience. And after having a beard that long, you will not believe how cold you are. that first cold snap.
Clarence, thank you so much. Well, that's what you're looking for, Dave. That's going to be a conversation starter when somebody like Clarence shows up at the implement store and his mustache and beard are gone.
Clarence, my main man, the Mobro to the West. I appreciate that.
Just to talk about mustaches on their own merits for a moment. I mean, it's part of this, you know, beards are having a heyday right now. There are beards everywhere. Mustaches, I don't think quite as much. Sometimes you get the very architectural mustaches with the mustache wax. Is that what makes it sort of more distinctive?
Yeah, I'd mentioned earlier, a lot of guys just have a lot of fun with it. I mean, we know that our wives and our girlfriends aren't going to necessarily love it, and maybe they don't want to see it in the family photo for Thanksgiving. But the whole idea is, you know, if you're around the dinner table at Thanksgiving, that's the prime time to have that conversation and to say why you're doing it. And once, you know, people understand the whole point of the mustache and how it separates us from, you know, No Shave November and things like that, you know, we use it as a tool. We grow it all month long. So especially if you do it by the regs and you shave it down on our shave the date, that's the 1st of November, we'll grow that over time. So I'm not sure about Clarence, but I don't have much of a mustache. It takes a few weeks to even look like anything besides just a little dirt on my upper lip. But once it finally comes in, you know, and at my office, I work at a company, Direct Supply, here in Milwaukee, and they really get behind charitable organizations and community involvement and things like that. So they'll let us produce a calendar, and we sell those as fundraisers for the following year. So at the end of the year, you know, I got a team of 43 strong at my company that are all doing it. We'll, you know, we'll take months of the calendar and have a really good time with it. So,
and Dave, you've done Movember each year lately, I imagine. Start with nothing and see how much you can build up by the end of the month.
Past seven, yeah. Seven. So,
and yep, do you go for the Raleigh fingers by the end of the month and get that mustache wax and get
Rob,
that twirl?
You have to be kidding! I mean, come on, that must have taken Raleigh fingers just years to manufacture. Although I do have a friend who we had a volleyball tournament for Movember. We raised about $3,000 on Saturday between volleyball and bags here locally in the area. And he's a coworker, and I hope he's listening. But I'm calling him out because he actually auctioned off his mustache. So one of the fun things you can do is say, okay, here's pick your style: Raleigh fingers, Salvador Dali, Burt Reynolds, or Captain Morgan. His last name happens to be Morgan, and everyone voted for Dali. So here he is showing up at the volleyball tournament, and this thing is so waxed and to a point, it's almost poking his eye out.
Wow,
it's pretty ridiculous.
Well, this is just a hypothetical day, but let's say a guy wanted to do this but couldn't grow a mustache.
Do you have somebody in mind here?
Oh, nobody in particular, Rob Ferret. But what if you want to participate and you can't really grow a mustache properly?
Sure, there's a lot of ways, and you know, we say it's for men's health awareness and causes and things, but we can't, you know, understate or underestimate the power of the Mocista. So we're all Mo Bros. We grow this mustache, but it's not just having the support of our wives. They're actually, I've got four women on our Direct Supply team, and they're either fiancés or girlfriends or of Mo Bros with my company, or just really good friends of mine. And you know, they have brothers, they have fathers, they have sons. You know, they could be impacted on either end of the spectrum, from testicular cancer from age 15 to 34, you know, all the way up to prostate and colorectal rectum cancer in the 40s and 50s. So, you know, understanding that, even if you can't grow the mustache, or if you're not willing to shave, you can still be a part of Movember. They're doing a Move challenge this year. It's a 30 days being active and doing something each day, and then you record that. So go to Movember.com. Once you're registered, you know, you start recording your moves. You take a picture. You can post them to social media. Let people know. People will donate off of that. So even if you're not growing the mustache, you're doing something, you know, to either not be sedentary if you're a man, or you know, if you're a Mo Sista, you're supporting men by showing us the way and kind of leading by example.
All right, we're 10 days into Movember. If people missed that shave the date on the 1st, is it too late for people to get involved now?
Absolutely not, Rob. No, we will we'll gladly have you anytime during November. You could shave it tonight as soon as you you finish listening to the Central Time program. You could do it in the morning. You could, even if you're not going to be a part of Movember, you can just go to Movember.com. You can look up any team, southeastern Wisconsin or otherwise. We'd love to get people in, 715-608-920, of course, and just find a friend who's doing Movember, or donate generally to Movember or to any team that's on there. So if you're thinking about starting it this week, still time to start a team, join a team to our Milwaukee network if you like. There's a lot of corporate challenges, a lot of industry challenges. So, you know, Pepsi Cola, Deloitte, this is national as well as global. I mean, it's over 21. It's in 21 countries. It's not just the states, but a lot of partnerships, a lot of connecting with clinicians and researchers to, you know, internationally to accelerate outcomes with men living with these cancers specifically.
And Dave, a quick word of encouragement to get men talking about their health.
Notice something, do something. I guess that would be what I'd leave you with, especially, you know, if you feel a lump somewhere. And again, it's in places we don't like to talk about because that can be embarrassing for men. Don't be afraid of a digital exam. You know, you're going to have to do it. And in your 50s, it's probably going to be a colonoscopy. When I think of what women have to go through annually and what they put themselves through with their doctors, you know, our message is, you know, let's saddle up and do the right thing, guys. Don't just think you can rub dirt on it and just get away with that forever.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Appreciate your time. Thanks for having me.
That's Dave Thorpe with Movember Milwaukee. You can find more about how to participate on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we find out the status of President Obama's executive order on immigration now that a federal appeals court ruled against it.
First, Republican voters get another chance to evaluate their party's presidential candidates tonight during a primary campaign debate in Milwaukee. As a couple of the GOP contenders made their way to Wisconsin yesterday, some likely voters were still trying to make up their mind. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Florida Senator Marco Rubio attended two fundraisers in southeastern Wisconsin. He also spoke to hundreds of people at a lively campaign rally in Pewaukee. Even the warm-up speaker, State Senator Leah Vukmir, was excited.
He is going to continue through Election Day to become the next president of the United States of Wisconsin, the United States of America.
Soon, Senator Rubio took the stage. He promoted technical college education, called for more competition for universities, and promised a stronger foreign policy.
We have a president that treats the prime minister of Israel with less respect than what he gives the Ayatollah of Iran. And that's why on my first day in office, I will cancel this reckless deal with Iran.
Opposition to the Iran nuclear arms deal and Rubio's promise to beef up the U.S. military are enough to put Oak Creek resident Sue Phillips in the senator's camp.
The fact that we need to be a stronger nation to our adversaries, that is the most important thing to me. We need to be the nation that we used to be, that we aren't anymore.
But just as public opinion polls do not have Senator Rubio up there with Ben Carson and Donald Trump at the top of the GOP presidential field, Heartland resident Mark Kelly also isn't ready to commit to Rubio, in part because Kelly sees a parallel with former Illinois Senator and now President Barack Obama.
I'm certainly willing to give him a chance, but senators have not had a good history of becoming powerful chief executives.
Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush also campaigned in Waukesha County yesterday and brought his own energy to the stage.
Woohoo! Yee!
Bush spoke at a Latino charter school and spent a lot of time promoting school vouchers in Florida.
Now 80,000 students are going to private schools because I took on very powerful interest, just as Scott Walker has done, to expand the voucher program statewide in this state.
Governor Walker attended Bush's event, but has made it clear he's not endorsing anyone yet. Neither is Larry Pesch of the charter school's operating agency, La Casa de Esperanza.
I'm undecided.
But Pesch calls Bush an honorable candidate, one of several in the GOP field.
I'm an awfully big believer in the character of a person is almost as important to me as their politics.
A voucher school parent from Milwaukee, Julio Maldonado, says he wants families to have more educational choice. Maldonado says he likes Jeb Bush, but also likes Florida Senator Rubio, as Maldonado says both have been more open to expanded immigration.
Because I have family who have been going through the system, have gone through the system in the past, and I want to make sure that they receive the right service for that.
In fact, Maldonado says he's so undecided that he hasn't ruled out voting for a Democrat next year. Today, Republican candidate Rand Paul also campaigned ahead of the debate, holding a roundtable in Milwaukee on school vouchers. Left-of-center groups are preparing for protest marches to the debate site. The eight leading Republican candidates square off in the main debate in Milwaukee at 8 p.m. after four take part in an undercard debate at 6 p.m. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we continue our coverage of tonight's debate in Milwaukee, focusing in on Governor Scott Walker. It's been over a month since he dropped out of the Republican presidential primary, but he's still making a splash in the Republican field. Yesterday, he appeared at separate events for Senator Marco Rubio and Governor Jeb Bush. Pundits say candidates are looking for a Scott Walker endorsement.
Here to talk about the role Governor Walker is playing in the Republican presidential primary is Ed Miller. He's a professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. Ed, welcome back to the show.
Good evening.
Well, as we know, Scott Walker dropped out of this race sometime back. Typically, do we see candidates who drop out still having some kind of influence, still playing a role in the ongoing primary?
Well, usually not. I mean, there's been some, candidates who challenged the winner ultimately, who are given choice of vice president, and certainly they may have some influence on the periphery. But in terms of key influence, probably not.
How significant is it that Governor Walker is appearing at fundraisers, as we heard Marco Rubio and for Jeb Bush? Is this a case that, hey, they are looking for his support particularly, or it's a Republican governor in a state they happen to be campaigning in and nothing more than that?
Right, and I think that's what it is. It's a Republican governor campaigning in the state, that the governor is popular with Republicans in the state, and so therefore what they're seeking is, as you just mentioned, money. And they would like, to fill their coffers. However, the governor is also seeking money because he's got a deficit in his campaign fund.
Governor Walker, as we mentioned, meeting with those candidates. And when he left the race, he said, not in exactly these words, but he said, hey, we need somebody to stand out from the field. Other people drop out, so we have a chance of beating somebody like Donald Trump. Do you think that establishment candidates are trying to rally to be that person, get the support, maybe not of Scott Walker in particular, but of Scott Walker and people like him, key players around the country in the Republican establishment?
Well, they're trying to certainly. Some people want them to narrow the field, and there are some questions about whether some of the candidates that are still running make very much of a splash in the field and make any difference. Walker, when he got out, said that he wanted others to get out of the race so that their supporters and their money would then go to other candidates, and there would be a sort of a whittling, and particularly in terms of Trump. He was very negative to Trump. Trump was very negative to Walker, and so he would like to see Trump knocked off.
Now, campaign donors, Scott Walker was raising a lot of money when he was peaking early, too early, it turned out, in the race. Have we seen where the money that was going toward Scott Walker is going now in terms of the other candidates?
Well, we don't know where some of the money is going, only because of the fact is that some of this money was secret. In other words, we don't know who gave exactly the money. But I think it's spreading out to some of the other candidates. They're certainly not going to Trump. There may be some going to Ben Carson and maybe a few of the other candidates, but some of them on the bottom side are having lots of problems raising money. Rand Paul, for example, has a lot of problem raising money, and there's some pressure on Rand Paul to drop out of the race. I mean, not only is he not have a great public backing for Rand Paul, but he's got a serious contest for re-election as senator, and Democrats are looking at that seat as a possible pickup in the next election. So if he doesn't give his attention to his own seat, you know, that could be one that falls into Democratic hands. So since he's so low on the polls, there are some people who are saying, well, wait a second, you obviously are not going to make this. Stop running for president and work on your Senate campaign. And so he's one. But there are other ones that are having trouble raising money as well.
Talking to Ed Miller from UW-Stevens Point about tonight's Republican debate here in Wisconsin. It's in Milwaukee. And looking at Wisconsin's role via Governor Walker and in other ways on this Republican primary. Now, when they announced this primary, Ed, it was going to be a home field advantage for Governor Scott Walker. He's now out of the race, but still here we are, a debate in Wisconsin. Candidates on their way to the debate campaigning in Wisconsin. Do you see the state, despite its later voting, playing a role? Are votes, Republican votes, actually mattering and who becomes the nominee?
Well, and we may, because there is now a regional primary, you know, for the South. So that's a lot of delegates there. And Wisconsin's got an interesting issue, because in Wisconsin's race, we have an open primary. And so as a result, if by the time of Wisconsin's primary, it appears that Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side has it sewn up, then a number of Democrats may decide, well, why am I going to vote, you know, in the Democratic primary? Because she's going to win. And so I'll vote in the Republican primary. And so they either will vote for the candidate they'd like the best. This is Democrats voting for the candidate they like the best. Or they will vote for the candidate that they think is to be the worst, what's referred to as raiding. So they could even raid the Republican primary. A number of years ago, the Democratic Party, the National Democratic Party, had trouble with Wisconsin's primary. And they would not let the Democratic Party in Wisconsin use the primary to select the delegates because it was an open primary. And ultimately, there was a case filed, and the National Party actually won that case, but then they relented to let the open primary select the delegates. But for that 1 year, there was in the Democratic side, there was a public relations campaign. In other words, who won publicly. But that didn't affect the delegates. The delegates were actually selected in caucuses, because of the National Party. But the Republican Party has its problem now, because if there's a lot of competition, the Democratic, between particularly Sanders, I assume, and Clinton, then that will keep the Democrats on the Democratic side. But if it appears by then that Hillary Clinton has it sewn up, some of those Democrats are going to vote in the Republican primary.
We're talking to political scientist Ed Miller about the Republican debate in Milwaukee tonight. Governor Walker and his role, if any, in the ongoing Republican presidential primary. We'll be talking a little more about what will actually happen in that debate tonight in just a little bit.
We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What role do you see Governor Walker playing, if any, and what do you think is going to happen in tonight's debate? What does everybody need to do to move ahead, achieve their goals? That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Ed Miller from UW-Stevens Point. We're talking about the role Governor Scott Walker could play in the Republican presidential primary now that he's dropped out of the race.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What role do you see Scott Walker playing in this race? Would you like to see him get the nod as a vice presidential candidate, as a running mate? Who do you think he should endorse? And looking at this debate tonight in Milwaukee, what are you looking for? What candidate are you liking? Are you watching closely on the Republican side of things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Ed, before we turn to tonight's debate, the concept of running mate Scott Walker. We had a Wisconsin vice presidential candidate, Paul Ryan, last time around. You can't predict the future, but do you think he's a likely contender?
Well, he's a likely contender because he is the governor. He was running the race, but what they're probably looking for, he doesn't have. I mean, he doesn't have foreign policy experience, for one thing. He comes from a relatively small state in terms of electoral votes. And so he can't do that. His public opinion rating was not very high. His poll rating when he was running, it fell. It was high, but then it fell, and his and currently his support at home is very low in Wisconsin. So for all that reasons, he doesn't seem like a good choice. There are some other better people out there.
Well, looking at tonight's debate, there are only 8 candidates tonight.
Right.
I usually wouldn't be saying only, but we've been seeing 10, I think in one case 11, on the stage. So a bit of sifting and winnowing there from the poll numbers. What are you looking for? What kind of things will you be watching for in this debate, mostly on economic issues tonight?
Right, and that's exactly right. The focus will be on economic issues. This is the Fox economic station together with the Wall Street Journal. And they will be focusing on things such as their tax policy. And their tax policies, interestingly enough, have been more detailed than traditionally the case. So they're not just saying cut rates or, you know, or reduce deductions, but they're actually giving some specifics to their policy. Now, one argument against their specifics is that we're going to lose a lot of money. I mean, there's not. For example, Trump, it's been estimated that we bring in less revenue than at any time since World War II. And so that kind of problem exists. The other issue is whether they deal with any of the entitlements, and particularly Social Security. And that could get them into trouble, because if they begin talking about some of the Ryan material on Social Security, such as privatizing Social Security, using a 403B kind of fund, or 401K actually more generally, if they begin talking about that, and Medicare, of course, Ryan has the proposal, which is similar to that, where you would use private companies. And so if they begin talking about that, that could create a lot of negative reaction, because as they say, both Social Security and Medicare are the third rail of politics. You touch it, you die. And so I think that's a dangerous area to go into, and they may get some questions on that.
This is an eternal struggle, isn't it, for presidential candidates? If they don't give detailed policy platforms, they're accused of being vague. But the risk is, if you do give platforms, A, the numbers may not add up, or at least B, it gives your opponents or ultimately the other party something to attack you with.
That's actually right. And the one that's given the least, of course, is Carly Farina. And she's not giving very much at all, other than saying that she's going to reduce the tax code to 3 pages. That's about all she said. Some are, you know, Ben Carson supports the flat tax, similar to the biblical concept of tithing, although he's now at 15%. You know, so that is his position. A lot of them want to eliminate or reduce the corporate taxes. We will see that. The idea that we have the highest corporate taxes in the United States, in the world, the United States has. And so the idea of reducing the corporate taxes, several of them want to reduce the capital gains taxes. The problem here is all of these proposals are balanced to the rich. And so consequently, richer individuals will get more from these proposals, because you're talking about reducing the top rates on these taxes. These proposals have been roundly criticized by Kasich, for example, who was the chairman of the Budget Committee in the House.
Talking to political scientist Ed Miller from UW-Stevens Point about tonight's Republican Party presidential debate. Well, let's break down some of the candidates here. One of the interesting stories, of course, is that the people with little political experience, direct political experience, are running the polls here. Donald Trump and Ben Carson at the top. And in their votes with Carly Fiorina, you have anywhere from 40 to 50% of Republican voters going with people with no political background. What do you make of that, Trump?
Well, it's a little strange, because on one hand, they're going with these, and these are outsiders, certainly. But on the other hand, when they're asked, you know, what is the most important thing, they often answer, like to the Wall Street Journal NBC poll, experience. So on one hand, they're saying experience, and on the other hand, they're supporting candidates that have little or no experience. And so it's a little dilemma. So some people think that these two candidates would sort of fade after the summer, but it's already November, and they haven't faded.
Thinking back in American history, the last person you can think of with no direct elected experience is maybe somebody like Dwight Eisenhower, and as a general running
right.
A major war operation, he had maybe some relevant experience there.
That's right, and the relevant experience in foreign policy, and both parties were trying to court Eisenhower at the time.
And getting to the rest of the candidates now, the ones maybe you call them establishment or ones with political experience, the ones Governor Walker was hoping somebody would emerge to challenge Donald Trump. Let's get into some of the names there. Marco Rubio seems to have a lot of momentum coming out of the last debate. Do you see him maybe emerging as that candidate?
Well, some people thought that he would be the one to emerge because Jeb Bush doesn't seem to be making it. Originally was Jeb Bush. Everybody thought, well, it's going to be some fights, and then Jeb Bush would come up. But right now, he's treading water. And so I don't know if Jeb Bush can do it. Rubio is another one people have talked about. He's in the Senate. But then he's got issues that may have an effect upon him. Certainly the financial issues, where he commingled funds on his credit card, you know, his personal funds on the Republican Party's credit card. That still dogs him. In addition to that, his voting. So, you know, they had mentioned in the last debate, you know, how much he did not vote while he was running for president and how many votes he missed. And his answer was, well, other candidates running for president missed the same number of votes. Well, actually, that wasn't exactly true, for one thing. But second is, if you look back over his other years that he wasn't running for president, he also missed a lot of votes. And so that could have an effect upon him.
And then Ted Cruz positioning himself as an experienced senator, but somebody out of the mainstream, somebody willing to take on his own party. Could he emerge as somebody that the people who like Donald Trump and Ben Carson and maybe the people who would like somebody as Scott Walker can converge on?
Right. I mean, it's possible. The only thing with Ted Cruz is he is not establishment, quite clearly. He's a Tea Party candidate. He's got a niche there that he's securing. But the question is, if he then ran as a candidate in the general election, he may be too far to the right. And that's what happened to Walker, too, that he thought he was straddling. It's what his argument was. He was straddling the more conservative and the establishment wings of the Republican Party. But as the campaign went on, he kept moving further and further to the right. So he's moved out of the establishment. And there's no question that Ted Cruz is not accepted by the establishment. For one thing is that many of the other Republicans in the Senate do not like Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz has criticized them. He has criticized the majority leader of his own party, which you tend not to do. And so Ted Cruz is sort of an outsider representing a particular group. That's true. But whether that group can secure the Republican nomination is questionable. And if they do, then the chances of winning the general are probably remote.
There's been talk in some of the previous debates about maybe fireworks and entertainment value crowding out substantial policy issues. As someone who observes the political process, what do we the people need to see? What are you hoping we get out of debates and other political conversation as we go through this presidential race?
Right. I think people should look at the answers and look at whether they actually answer the questions. They've been very negative on the moderators, although some of the questions may be somewhat questionable. But the fact is that a lot of the questions, if you look at that CNBC debate and you actually look at the questions, okay, there was a few that may be not very proper, but a lot of the other questions were looking at the heart of the matter, at the heart of the tax matter, those kinds of things they were asking. So those questions are very, very appropriate. And I wonder whether the Fox group, which people think are going to throw them softballs, I wonder whether they really are. Because on that panel is an editor from the Wall Street Journal, as well as Maria Bartiromo. And she's not been known to pull punches. She was with CNBC until 3 years ago. And she's now, I bet there's going to be some strong questions asked. But the people should look at, A, what they say, specifically say in answer to the question, and whether they answer the questions. I was very amazed with Ben Carson when he was asked a question about prices of drugs, which has been in the news, all kinds of problems. He was a pediatric neurosurgeon, and he never answered the question.
Ed, thanks a lot for being with us again today.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking to Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point, looking at tonight's Republican presidential debate taking place in Milwaukee. Undercard debate at 6 p.m. Central, main debate at 8 o'clock tonight.